Yeah, I'm going to give a bit of a tour of what has been done in quantum gravity at PI. As you can see, PI has the right building to think about space-time and quantum space-time. And sometimes, you know, you have a surprise and it end up upside down and there's a go around corners and so on and get lost. So as we know since Einstein, gravity is much more about space-time than a single force. So the nice thing about quantum gravity is that it forces you to think about quantum space-time. And so you have basically three fundamental concepts there, quantum, space, and time. And so there's many exciting and fundamental questions which come up if you try to think about how do you quantize gravity. And here are some of the questions which I could think of. So basically I think Lucien raised it, is causality fundamental? You know, is there some quantum concept of causality? What is time? Lee can give you an answer, apparently. What are actually the degrees of freedom of quantum space-time? Is quantum space-time, is it emergent? Is it fundamental? You know, we came up also with in Kenrick's talk, and I will speak about it a bit more. What is space-time vacuum? And then there's these applications, quantum cosmology and quantum black holes, which I don't mention at all, unfortunately. And these questions, locality, causality, and symmetries will be central. So basically what we quite often face is the problem of reconstructing quantum space-time if you are one of these fans which try to start from the bottom and try to build things up. So we have lots of ideas, or you put your basically favorite idea of what could be quantum gravity, what are the fundamental degrees of freedoms, what are my fundamental symmetries and fundamental principles into something which you call your fundamental theory. Quite often, not always, you know, you derive something, and this process is already quite difficult, which might end up in, you know, basic building blocks of your quantum space-time. these could be a priori auxiliary or discrete. And the hard challenge is basically to bridge this, you know, an enormous amount of scales to extract low energy or large scale physics and to make a connection to reality. And so this problem a priori is very near basically condensed matter. And if you would have complete control over, you know, tune something in your fundamental theory, that's how it changes reality, we would be, of course, easily could select whatever theory we have here. So the question is, the challenge typically is to go from here to here. And one idea is to use renormalization. Renormalization comes also up in a, say, realist approach, a top-down approach, where you start from Einstein gravity and say, okay, I have these metric degrees of freedom, and I believe in metric degrees of freedom. And then I test what will happen if I follow basically functional renormalization group flow. So that gives me a connection between infrared and UV in one or the other direction, if I manage to solve that. You hope yet that you actually find a fixed point in the UV, and for instance, asymptotically safe gravity hopes to basically find this non-Gaussian fixed point. So in some sense, they have found it, but it depends on the truncation. And so you start here, you start with basically more reality and go down to see whether you find a consistent UV theory. The nice thing is you can get actually predictions and ask the test on it. If you put matter in it, it will change slightly your flow, and you can check whether you still find a new UV point, UV fixed point. And I guess so far Astrid is quite happy about the LHC results because they're consistent with these predictions. It's basically, Dario has talked about it a lot, about this problem. It's basically a question whether you have unitarity in the end. It's basically also a question whether you have infinitely many couplings or not. You know, if you allow for infinitely many higher curvature terms. Yeah, but in principle, you know, you have an infinite dimensional theory space. So the other nice thing about doing quantum gravity is you're paid for thinking about nothing, which is basically one, you could say it's actually a very fundamental problem, namely what is vacuum? And basically one idea, so this problem came up, is more or less a no boundary proposal, and indeed, in many approaches, you manage to associate amplitude to a fundamental building block. And so in this example, we basically, I'm one dimension down. so imagine you have basically this S2. So you have a chunk of space-time, which in this case is a ball. And you consider the boundary of this ball, which is a sphere. And in principle, you know, you have some geometric data here on the sphere. And so, for instance, spin foams tells you, given this, given geometric data, I give you an amplitude or a wave function, which is unique. Because basically there's no other boundary where you can tune anything. So you would have another boundary if you would make a hole in the sphere and have an inner boundary, but you close this. So this is a unique wave function, and actually you always want to build it such that you get something which gives you the Einstein action, hopefully, in this case. So that indeed you could hope to get gravity at some point. And so you can actually say that this fundamental building block automatically gives you a notion of a vacuum wave function, which corresponds to the Hartle-Hawking wave function, associated to a closed boundary. So this is again a bit related to what Lucien's challenge was. Robert Oeckel, which probably was here a number of times, proposed basically this generalized boundary there's a generalized boundary proposal of Robert Oeckel, which corresponds to having very general boundaries here in quantum gravity. and given this vacuum, you could complain it's a very coarse representation of the vacuum because you put all the geometric data of the sphere just in one simplex in this case. So here, in this case, you have just six numbers, which give you, for instance, the length of this tetrahedron. So you can actually produce a finer representation of a vacuum so that you have put more data on have a chance to put more data on the sphere. And this automatically you get by doing a kind of path integral evolution with these building blocks. So basically, you glue all these building blocks together, you integrate over all inner degrees of freedom which you get, and imagine you get a big, big sphere with lots of, you know, which is very refined. So you could say that in this way, you actually reach the continuum limit, and you have a refined vacuum wave function. So the point is that ideally, you would actually try to think about these two wave functions not representing different states, but being the same state. And I'll come to that later. So we have spoken about producing a refined state for the vacuum. You can actually do that with a general state. So you take any state, which now you can tune having another boundary, and you add basically tetrahedra, and you add the tetrahedra with this unique vacuum state. So what you did do is you basically add degrees of freedom, as you can see, because doing this, you basically get more edges and have more data. So in principle, you add degrees of freedom, but all these degrees of freedom are added in the vacuum state. So you see that you get a refined state again, and you have a very well-defined notion of basically how to connect coarser states with finer states. And actually, this nicely fits with techniques which came up in condensed matter to coarse-grain condensed matter systems, and basically we are applying them in for quantum gravity. So this notion of refinement actually can be used to define the refinement or the continuum limit formulation of a theory. That's what is basically the big challenge. And indeed, for topological theories, so topological theories basically only depend, as the name suggests, on the topology of your boundary. So in this case, it's indeed the case that the vacuum wave function, in a sense, is not different for these two examples. So these two examples will give you the same information because they encode the same topology. In this case, a quite simple topology. And in this case, because of this discretization independence, there's a technique which is called projective or inductive limit, depending on what you do, used in loop quantum gravity to construct your continuum Hilbert space. And this defines you basically what is your vacuum and what are your excitations. So you start with your basic amplitude. So it might come from a topological field theory. In this case, it's very much related to these topological phases used in condensed matter. You start with that vacuum state. It actually allows you, with this notion of refinement, to determine what are the observables which have a certain stability under this refining time evolution. And these observables determine the kind of excitations you get. And doing a so-called inductive limit construction, you can define your continuum Hilbert space for your excitations. And so you can do that for instance, in loop quantum gravity. And this allowed us to basically define recently second vacuum for loop quantum gravity. So it's actually a very deep question, basically, what is the most fundamental vacuum for quantum gravity? And one proposal is that you start with a vacuum which is completely peaked on spatially degenerate geometries. So all expectation values of all your spatial operators are completely zero. And this is what happens in the so-called Ashtika-Lewandowski vacuum, where all these the so-called electrical fields actually encode spatial geometrical data. And the wave function has maximal uncertainty in the conjugated variables, which happens to be a connection. So you have this property of the Ashtika-Lewandowski vacuum, which tells you, okay, spatial geometry is completely degenerate. So now the problem is, if you want to reach low energy physics, is that first you have to build up a smooth geometry from nothing, which is, of course, a very hard job. In addition, basically, you have these excitations which you get. There are these famous spin network states, and they are supported on one-dimensional submanifolds, so on graphs. So you have to basically come up with a very dense filling of this of your three-manifold to have a reasonable state. Alternatively, you can actually do something which is kind of well-known statistical physics. It's a duality transformation. And you get something which is a BF theory vacuum, where everything is dualized. So in this case, you peak on flat connection. So the curvature identically vanishes. On the other hand, you have maximal uncertainty in spatial geometry. So you have basically a flat, and this the distribution here in this spatial geometry is flat. This Gauss just means that it satisfies the Gauss constraints, these data. And you also dualize the excitations. And in this case, you are in three dimensions. So the dual to a line in three dimensions is the surface. So your excitations kind of live now on pieces of surfaces. That's the picture here. And so there's also a question. So Kozlowski, who has been a postdoc here, defined a vacuum where you don't peak on zero triads or zero spatial geometry, but you have a background triad. So here is also a question whether you can do something similar, and this time with a curvature. Okay, and that is basically a general principle how you could try to define continuum Hilbert spaces out of a topological series, at least if you manage to discretize them. Of course, gravity in 4D, in 3D it's actually topological, so that works nicely in 3D. In 4D it's non-topological, and your job gets slightly harder. And there's work going on using basically tensor network renormalization techniques from condensed matter to construct the continuum or refinement limit in this case. And the first question you want to answer is, are there reasonable basically faces or topological series around? And this picture shows you some examples of these topological series for a certain analog system. So this already is a phase diagram for so-called quantum group spindles. There's also other work going on using coherent spin networks, which is a bit more analytical, and this previous work is basically numerical. So what I spoke about is really getting the continuum limit via refining, and as I wanted to motivate, therefore this refining, this notion of vacuum is central. You could also try to think about getting the continuum limit via summing over geometries. So these are two big directions. And if you ask Matteo, he might tell you that it's really the same. So this is, again, a path integral approach, where basically you want to find a notion for the sum over all geometries, because that's what you have to do in the path integral. You kind of want to sum find the path integral where you find a method to sum over all geometries with a given amplitude. And many of these models basically use, again, some kind of triangulation where the degrees of freedom are encoded in the way you glue a manifold out of your basic building blocks. So it's a very complicated combinatorical question, because you have to basically find out how many ways are there to, you know, glue a certain manifold or glue a manifold with certain properties given a certain number of triangles, tetrahedrons, and so on. And indeed, say in causal dynamical triangulations, it's mostly numerical, except in 2D you can solve it. But there's actually nice techniques for coming from matrix models and then for tensor models to do these sums in a sense analytical. And these techniques rely on Feynman expansion. And so we go kind of perturbative again. So the idea is quite simple. You know, you actually take just quantum field theory. You know that the quantum field theory expansion in a perturbative parameter produces graphs. So if you take zero-dimensional quantum field theory, you basically get here a sum over graphs with some combinatorical factors. This doesn't really look like a manifold. However, if you replace your scalar field with a matrix, then if you can again basically define this expansion, and what you get from the combinatorics is so-called ribbon graphs, and if you dualize it for every vertex here, you draw a triangle, you get actually a sum over two-dimensional triangles. And indeed, these matrix models count you the number of geometries by basically doing this integral, you sum over all geometries and topologies in 2D. And there's a famous technique which is known as large N expansion. So it happens that if you choose this parameter N, which gives you the size of the matrix you integrate over, if you choose it large, it happens that the amplitudes are such that the spherical triangulations, this triangulation spherical topology dominate. And nicely, you can actually also get the continuum limit. And to get the continuum limit, you tune this coupling constant to the critical value, where surfaces with many triangles dominate. So you basically find them peakwise, you go to the critical value where many, the Feynman diagrams with many, many vertices are completely dominating. There's a generalization of that to higher dimensions, where you now integrate over basically tensors, and the rank of these tensors determines your space-time dimension. So in this case, it's 3D. And there's also some graphical stuff around it. and so there's these tensor models, which just give you a combinatorial amplitude and group field theories, where basically the amplitude for a single contribution equals a spin form, amplitude. And it would be nice to have, you know, the same results as matrix models. It's a priori very difficult, because in 2D, at least you can count topologies. In 3D, it's unfortunately not the case, and there's much more what can happen in terms of generalized triangulations, which might not really describe you manifolds. So there was a long problem. So tensor models were suggested some time ago, I think in early 90s, and Gurao, I think in around 2010, he actually said he found a technique to basically put more control over the sum over triangulations, so basically more control over the kind of triangulations you sum over by introducing colors. If you know Raswan, it's really hard to find actually a picture where he really uses colors, so for him it's numbers. But these colors basically restrict the way you can glue these triangulations together. And if you do it cleverly, if you can find a way which gives you something equivalent to an 1 over n expansion, that means that you can find actually the contributions which dominate for large n. These contributions happen to be not really characterized by topology, but by being so-called melonic. Here you see a very melonic contribution. But it allows you to construct the continuum limit. Actually, what you would like to do is also something very similar to matrix models, to have some kind of double scaling limit. And it triggered lots of developments, also in group field theories, because with these methods, you can actually consider renormalization properties of group field theories, and there's a number of people at PI, which have been at PI or still at PI, which are involved in this, in these things. So here you do something funny because you actually use kind of a perturbative expansion, because it relies on, you know, writing something generating Feynman diagrams as an expansion in your coupling constant. So there's a question whether you can actually kind of study all these models kind of more non-perturbatively in this coupling constant. And indeed, you can use a functional renormalization group flow. And recently, this has been done by Astrid and Tim Koslowski. And there's an interesting question here again, which is usually renormalization flow happens in a scale. You flow from small scales to large scales, which a priori in quantum gravity is not well defined because scale is supposed to be a dynamical variable. So the answer here is actually that n, the size of the metric itself, is a flow parameter. And it gives you an pass, you know, for me it's a puzzling answer to what is renormalization scale. So in this example, it's basically the size of the matrix. And indeed, in group field theory, the size of the matrix is related to a quantum geometrical observable. And in fact, the length or the eigenvalues of the area variables. So these functional renormalization group flows allow you to study non-perturbatively the renormalization group flow. And so they have given basically a recipe for tensor models, and that might be applied in future. And so far, the discussion is usually about Gaussian fixed points, but there's this interesting question, does there exist any non-Gaussian fixed point? Okay. So we have seen one answer to what is renormalization scale. So we come to some other question, which is what is time? And recently there has been another interesting word, which is not so much related with renormalization flow, but with some other flow, namely the flow of time. So it's a proposal for the gravitational arrow of time. It comes from an approach which was also mostly invented at PI, shape dynamics. In this case, you have actually global time, which you get by saying you take a so-called constant mean curvature gauge, which basically gives you a notion of what are your equal hypersurfaces in your manifold. And this leads to conformal geometry as being the true degrees of freedom of gravity, and therefore the name or the relation to shape dynamics. And so the proposal is very, very interesting in one aspect. So what they did was to consider kind of an analog shape dynamic system, namely the Newtonian n-body problem in shape space. So you only consider basically relative distances and so on. And you can define a so-called complexity measure. And so what you find is that for generic trajectories, the complexity measure does always the following. You know, it basically goes down, then you find some point where you have minimal complexity, and then it goes up. So it's not necessarily monotonic because it fluctuates, but in average, you find this behavior. And so their credo now is basically two futures, one past, that this gives you basically the past, and that you can be either here or here and get either this future or this future. And on the other hand, that this growing of complexity gives you also another notion of time and explains basically irreversible behavior with time symmetric laws. So you have one of the answers was, what is time? And I'm quite finished. So, you know, I hope that actually many things will happen in the near future because we have actually developed many techniques which will tell us more about the continuum limit, renormalization flow, and finally, actually, to derive predictions. If you want to see more, there's basically the Pilser talks from Loops 13, which give you a wide overview of many developments, which I didn't mention here. And there's also a workshop on renormalization approaches and quantum gravity in April. And sometimes we even do music in our papers and in Praxis. Okay, thank you.
So Bianca finished 10 minutes early, so we have some time for questions.
Thanks. So I wanted to ask about indefinite causal structure. So in your graphs, should I think of the links between the vertices as corresponding to some given causal relationship, or is it?
No, it's not a causal set.
It's not a causal set. Okay, so then in that case, how do you?
I mean, this the picture I showed.
Yeah.
They were also just spatial.
They're just spatial.
Spatial geometry.
And then you evolve that spatial geometry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then how do you? I mean, do you achieve something like indefinite causal structure, or is that not a feature of this? Because if you have a state evolving in time, it suggests that you have. Definite causal structure there.
Yeah, yeah. If you do spin forms with Lorentzian signature, you get at least fluctuating. You get a notion of fluctuating light cones and fluctuating causal structure.
Well, where's the fluctuation coming from? What's it fluctuating?
It's basically that every basic building block, you know, comes with a light cone structure.
Okay.
And then you build them up with, you glue them in different ways,
uh-huh.
And a priori, you know, you get something which might fluctuate. So you have to really define how to measure fluctuations of your light cone structure. And that is kind of an involved problem because you have to really define an observable and
okay.
You know, integrate over and make sense out of it.
Okay.
But in principle, you could do that. So it's something where you would say you don't, it's not as axiomatic building in causality as, say, in causal sets.
Okay, I have to look.
Okay.
Quantum, the whole issue of quantum gravity spans a lot of distance and time. Einstein was opposed to quantizing gravity. And recently, Freeman Dyson has questioned whether we should quantize gravity because you can't detect a graviton. It's very difficult to do so. So my question is, in physics, we have to confront theory ultimately with experiment to verify or falsify theories. What quantum gravity data can we anticipate can verify or falsify all these different models?
So there's basically one big falsification, which is a big error question mark, is to get just first, you know, the real world out of your model. That's a big challenge. Furthermore, there are different proposals, which I didn't mention, which come from quantum cosmology and Lorentz symmetry deformation. And so there's some astrophysical predictions coming from these things, and also some predictions from, for instance, for WMAP data. So these are some examples where basically you use large distances to amplify tiny effects.
Any other questions?
So you very modestly skipped rather quickly over your numerical work showing these new phases. Could you just elaborate on those and say what are the prospects for showing you've really found continuum spacetimes or quantum spacetimes in this way?
So these numerical data, I mean, this example is basically kind of coming from some simulations and lower dimensional examples where we believe that it already tells us something about actually the full four-dimensional theory. So to completely confirm this, the question is how much can you really scale the numerical simulations from two dimensions to four dimensions. But basically with the development I have seen, like starting maybe 2 years ago from nothing to this now, is already a bit surprising that we managed to go so far with not many tools. I guess something, it's doable. So at least to go to three dimensions and say something in four dimensions on this scale.
Just sticking to two dimensions, how convinced are you by this that there is a continuum quantum geometry being described?
So it's more a question about interpretation. So in 2D, I mean, every phase defines you some kind of quantum geometry.
But is it a completely irregular geometry, or is it cutoff dependent, or you know?
No, these fixed points in every case give you a kind of topological field theory. So in this case, you know, it's a phase. It's similar to a topological phase, topological field theory. So you don't have any cutoff dependence.
Is that built into the model in the beginning?
No, it's basically just a general feature of statistical systems that you see these fixed points. The challenge is to really determine, to go to a phase transition and find something which is non-topological for 4D gravity. Because in 3D, actually 3D, we have a nice space-time in 3D. In a sense, we have a complete theory of quantum gravity for 3D. And it's, you know.
But there may even be 2D models which have continuum degrees,
yeah.
Non-trivial continuum degrees of freedom.
One example is Liouville theory. Yeah. In this case, if you could say it comes from Liouville theory. Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody disagrees. It's a bit difficult to get this theory from this quantum geometric approach. Or from refining, so it's one question whether there will be a connection at some point. So it could happen if you really consider basically the phase transition here. I mean, this gives you, in principle, you expect at least a conformal field theory there.
If you found a second order phase transition.
If you find a second order.
And so far you haven't found any.
I think we have indications for a second order phase transition because uh-huh. that you can see from the behavior of your simulations. How long they take, but I don't want to make any claims.
Mm-hmm. What are the indications? Is one of those points looks like it might be second order?
You don't see that from the points, but you see that from the behavior of how long it takes for a simulation to converge to a fixed point. And so around the second order fixed points, it gets longer and longer and harder and harder.
So you do see that? Maybe.
Maybe it depends on the scale you ask.
Okay, are there any other questions? So are you optimistic that the way you construct the new vacuum could also give some new approach to constructing the physical Hilbert space of LQG in four dimensions?
Yeah, because it's basically the same. So the way we construct this new vacuum, it's basically the same way we do this coarse graining or use this refining. So it actually for us was more a test to test this idea of constructing a physical vacuum with this topological field theory, and it kind of works. So we are kind of happy about this test.
Okay, any more questions? If not, then let's thank the speaker again.